including the tactical aviation slice that was to go into Mobile Command. And that was to be the fair of that command. All commands were going through the same thing. But it seemed to be a particular horror story down in Mobile because of trying to get together. You're right.
How effective could you have been during this period?
The battalions, first of all, the terrible problem of how many regiments, how many infantry armored and artillery regiments were to be maintained, retained and maintained, with a problem that I hadn't in the case of particularly well yes in the case of infantry, the question of rebadging between regiments. I hadn't realized what a shocking problem that was, but in those days, for instance, you had the black watch. And let me see if I can remember what regiments there were at that point in time. Those that were retained were the PPCLI, the RCR, and the Van Dues. And they finally dropped the Black Watch, the Canadian Guards. Can you recall what other regiments were dropped?
I'm thinking of the Black Watch.
The Black Watch, the Canadian Guards. There was one other. I know there was one other.
Mm-hmm.
In any event. Well, in addition then to the restructuring was this problem of how many infantry regiments were to remain active, the others going on reserve. And the same, of course, applied to the gunners and the cavalry. Seems to me that the field engineers and the signals crowd didn't seem to have the same hassle. But with all of that in the pot, for the first time, aviation was hard against these chiefs of the other arms. And the Army to this day still look upon aviation as another arm that indeed the Army feels should be under Army command. But you won't get me agreeing to that, and you'll get damn few airmen agreeing to it. And I could tell you stories after story on that one. But aviation, how to put it? I won't say constantly under attack, but we really had to go back philosophically to square one. You know, back to the 1918, 1919, 1920s when aviation in the form of RAF and then later RCF broke away from the Army, and in the case of the Brits, the RNAS as well. But we had to go back to square one and defend and explain
your existence.
Our existence. We did not have the luxury of saying, artillery, what the hell are you doing alive? But the gunners felt free to take on
cavalry.
if you knew your business, if you were professional and knew your business, this was a very useful period in a professional's career where. Whereas so many airmen had floated happily, freely, generously all through the late 40s, the 50s, and early 60s,
mm-hmm.
the air defense crowd, you know, lots of money, let's go, charge up. Here now you were being drawn back to square one.
Going for the lowest common denominator.
And it was a demanding experience, I tell you.
Did it turn very many people sour, do you think?
No, but if you couldn't handle yourself in these discussions, I think you could quickly develop a raging inferiority complex, because you were literally constantly under attack, both in the office and every time you go to the bar, someone would come up and want to not pick a fight with you, but we want to discuss a very fundamental point, and
Here you were defending a service.
And here you were defending a service. Now, it brought home to Ehrman for the first time the real difference in cultures, if you like. And this was a great expression of Bill Anders. You know, this is a clash of cultures, and what turns a soldier on doesn't move an airman off his chair. Say, what made airmen good airmen just wasn't understood by, you couldn't expect it to be by an infantryman or a gunner. Even though some of those arms had their own aircraft, we airmen just deplored the way they handled their helicopter and AOP stuff. So as we got further into this, we had our ammunition too, and were able to challenge the other arms on how they conducted their business, as they were so fond of challenging us. But they were tiring years. In addition to this major ongoing structural thing, size and shape of mobile command, this constant professional challenge. Not all of it pleasant. Mostly pleasant. Not all of it. You know, you felt as though you were surrounded and in a state of a siege, and not from all soldiers, but from most.
There were enough there to keep you cooking.
There were enough there to keep us busy, and some were manifestly anti-air, and we had.
Well, seeing that we're talking the esoteric here, what about the philosophy that the Army should have an air wing or whatever, and the Navy should have an air arm, and that after all, all air is a weapon system, and therefore they should be told what to do, not having any choice on the decisions. Or
yeah, well, you know,
I'm sure you've heard that argument.
Yes, readily, and I only have to turn the pages of history back to those days in Mobile Command, and I'll give you all the answers. But the point, now remember that the big armies and big navies and big countries are still doing that today. But the fundamental difference is, but all big countries also have separate air forces, and the more exotic, the more costly. The air arm is just another weapon system, but it's a weapon system of another order, a high order, requiring special expertness, special professionalism, special knowledge, says the airman. I don't think you'd get all the infanteers agreeing with me, or all the sailors, but when you are a small country, as Canada is, small in terms of military forces, if you fragment your aviation in small penny packets around the services, and indeed within the services, you know, the infantry wanted their own aircraft, the gunners wanted theirs, etc., etc., it becomes a very costly operation, and you either have to reduce the number of aircraft to achieve that kind of fragmentation, or go the other route, consolidate. And we, as airmen in Mobile Command, were fighting for consolidation, and in fact we won that one, and I believe it's working fairly well today. I think if you're bigger and have money, the other way.
If you had the money, you wouldn't need unification. You'd have the three services and the...
Yeah, perhaps.
In the case of the Americans, four with the Coast Guard and all the good stuff.
And the Marine Corps.
And the Marine Corps, five.
Yeah. Well, except Marine. Well, no, except Marine hates sailors. Anyway. Well, is that... You think that covers us?
I think we...
Mobile Command experience. I was damn fortunate. Where accolades are due, I'll give them. Bill Anderson was eminently fair. Now, this in sharp and not a traditionalist in the sense, as I mentioned earlier, that my brigadier boss back in senior appointments, Anderson was a first class professional and gave aviation a fair shake, but expected aviation to make its point and sell it and sustain it, and I don't know what would have happened to a weak airman in a situation like that. He couldn't have taken the heat, and he'd have moved off. But I found it a damn useful experience, and
I guess it didn't hurt being an air commodore, though. You'd only be taking heat from a select few.
Yeah, but you're talking rank. I'm talking a professional challenge.
Yes.
And when a gunner colonel takes you nose to nose with a crowd gathered around,
rank don't count. Eh?
Rank don't count. You'd better be pretty damn. You better know your stuff and be pretty damn nimble on your feet, or they'll try and eat you alive before the eyes of their staff. And now that's fair game. That's stimulating. And if you can't hack it, move out. They were good days, long days though. My word. And I suppose more than anything was this dreadful frustration of never knowing what the size of your force was going to be 1 month to the next, and the wasted effort, the wheel spinning that we went through. I say wasted. It turned out to be wasted. At the time, we thought we were putting together a pretty good
unrewarding
force. Unrewarding. Hear, hear. And tough days for the Army, I must admit. You know, moving into this functional bit when their every urge was to remain geographic. The Army are land occupiers, and they just really didn't grab this functional bit. I think it was tougher on the Army. And of course, superimposed on all of this from day one, 1964, the very beginning of unification, was the bicultural bilingualism problem that was overlaid the whole bit. And if you think that wasn't a skip, trying to crank that factor in as well, we could have. From 64 on, there was the integration, unification, the bicultural bilingualism. I can't remember which came first, the fixed budget or the shrinking budget. And any one of those events would have preoccupied a military force. We had the whole bundle imposed at the same time. They were testy days.
What about the bilingualism, biculturalism? Basically speaking, thinking of the Army, it was a pretty waspish preserve. Not too many French airmen that I can think of.
You said Army.
Well, I said, well, starting with the Army.
Yeah.
The Army component is pretty much it's the British Raj, if you will.
Well, what I knew, I personally knew several French-speaking major generals and brigadiers.
Yeah, but I'm thinking the exception of the Bandus.
No, General Bernache, General Fleury, General Allard, General Dextres, with the whole gaggle of senior ranks below them, they were general rank long before B&B.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm getting at what I'm trying to get at, I guess, is what was the reactions of the whole bilingual, bicultural, let's have two exit signs as opposed to one.
Well, I don't, I on the question of by culturalism, you know, the broad national social aspect of it. The forces reacted depending on your
persuasion.
No, well, depending on your race of origin, reacted exactly the way other Canadians reacted. We weren't exempt. Except any of us who would work closely with French units knew what damn good people they were. And
well, I guess what I'm getting at is that the language, the overt, say the French soldier had now the right, if you will, as opposed to the courtesy. That have the right to work in his language, to expect his orders to come down in his language.
Yeah, except as it does in NATO, the operational language to this very day is English. That is the NATO standard, and it remained the standard in the Canadian forces as well. The operational language still is English. Now that can be translated down to a lower French.
I'm just wondering if any of the old Brits, if you will, or transplanted Brits of.
Sure, they reacted. They didn't. They weren't. You know, they weren't enthusiastic about it at all. Let's not fog it. It was tough sledding. And
still is,
and it's we're far from a national resolution on it.
Was there ever at that time, sir, the principle, philosophy, whatever you wish to call it, that if one wishes to get ahead in the Canadian forces in the future, one must become bilingual?
Yes, indeed.
That come in at this particular point?
It was manifesting itself, certainly. No question about it. And if you were bilingual or even better multilingual, that was an increasingly significant plus. And of course all of us were encouraged to, all the English speaking chaps were encouraged and gals were encouraged to take courses in French and become bilingual, and courses were being set up, and you were being given opportunity. Usually, but you know, it was a dilemma, because if you took on as many did that task, it supposedly would take place during your working hours, but the work that accumulated while you were off learning French, hopefully. Did not disappear. So what any of us, most of us, had to do was go back at nights or go back on weekends to get caught up, unless you were posted right out of an active appointment to a language school, which a few got that, but mostly it was superimposed and made for a longer week, I can tell you. Some just tried it, couldn't hack it. I was one. I have no lingual skills, I can get along in French if I have to, but I'm far from fluent. Far. Now, theoretically, it should have impeded my advance, but I was a unilingual Englishman who or English speaking, I'm a Welshman, really. English speaking.